From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. So lots happening in the world of politics this week. Iran is high on the White House agenda as President Barack Obama pens a letter to Russia with love. Well, not quite. And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talks missiles and diplomacy in the Middle East. Plus, Britain's Prime Minister Gordon Brown drops in at the Oval Office. But can America's special relationship or partnership with the UK bring an end to the global financial crisis? And the chairman of the Republican National Committee, Michael Steele, says sorry to radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh. More details in a moment. To discuss all of these stories, I am joined now by Sherrilyn Ifill, a civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies. He is also a former special assistant to George W. Bush. Ron, Sherrilyn, nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to be with you.
Quite a week. Let's start with the last story that we mentioned, that the chairman of the Republican National Committee, Michael Steele, apologizing to conservative commentator and talk show host Rush Limbaugh after calling him, quote, an entertainer. It all kicked off on D.L. Hughley's show on CNN on Saturday night.
We don't need incendiary rhetoric.
Exactly.
Like Rush Limbaugh, who is the de facto leader of the Republican Party.
He's No, he's not.
Well, I'll tell you what. I've never heard anybody.
I'm the de facto leader of the Republican Party.
Then you know what? then I can appreciate that.
And there's more.
Rush Limbaugh's an entertainer. Rush Limbaugh, his whole thing is entertainment. Yes, it's incendiary.
Right.
Yes,
yeah,
it's
you
ugly.
Get the sense that he would
say
anything.
He influences the party. And I tell you what, you're the first Republican I've talked to, and I've talked to a lot, that said he's not the leader of this party. I've never heard anybody say that on any show.
Now, of course, Rush Limbaugh wasn't very happy to remain quiet on the subject. Here is his response to Michael Steele's comments on his radio show on Monday.
Tens of millions of conservatives and Republicans have nothing to do with the RNC, and right now they want nothing to do with it. And when you call them, asking them for money, they hang up on you. It's time, Mr. Steele, for you to go behind the scenes and start doing the work that you were elected to do, instead of trying to be some talking head media star, which you're having tough time pulling off.
Okay, Sherrilyn, I'm going to come to you first. What do you make of Steele's comments and Rush Limbaugh's reaction and Steele's mea culpa? It was kind of painful to watch.
It was painful but very revealing and I think important. I think people are now really seeing what a rudderless ship the Republican Party is, because when you, as a body of elected officials across the United States, have to rely on a talk show host to be your leader, and when the leader of the Republican National Committee is essentially frightened to say what is the truth, which is that Rush Limbaugh is an entertainer, that you know his rhetoric may be ugly and maybe incendiary. I thought that was actually a pretty mild description of what Rush Limbaugh does. That he had to backtrack and eat his words. And so it really shows the kind of fear, and he's not the only one. I mean, there have been several others who've criticized Rush Limbaugh in recent weeks, and they've had to all backpedal and come back and apologize for criticizing a talk show host. I think it's extraordinary and really speaks to the leaderlessness of the Republican Party that's fresh out of ideas and fresh out of credible leaders.
Well, let's turn to a Republican. Ron, you are here with us. We have this spat between the chairman and the man seen as, by some, the leader of the conservative. What issues do you think are raised through this whole exchange? The Democrats obviously salivating over this. Do you think this is damaging to the party?
No, of course I don't. I mean, this is my favorite Shakespeare play, Much Ado About Nothing. I mean, the fact of the matter is that Rush Limbaugh is a very influential voice in the conservative movement. The Democrats have decided, well, George Bush isn't around, no Dick Cheney, no Karl Rove. We need a new boogeyman. We need a new scapegoat. And Rush Limbaugh is the perfect embodiment for the Democrats now to find somebody who they love to hate. The fact of the matter is I listen to Rush's show on a daily basis. I enjoy it. I think it was a mistake for Michael Steele to have called his show ugly and incendiary, because it's not, and that's what he apologized for. But the Democrats to go around and to suggest that Rush is the head of the party is wrong. But listening to his show today, Tony, I found this interesting. Rush said on his show today, he said, well, if the Democrats are going to say that I'm the leader of the Republican Party and that President Obama is the head of the Democratic Party as well as the president, then why don't we have a debate? Since they want to make me the leader of the party, let us have a debate. So now I would turn it back on the Democrats and say, if the Democrats are so interested in pointing and painting Mr. Limbaugh as the leader of the Republican Party, which he's not, then why don't the president and Mr. Limbaugh have a debate so that'll satisfy the Democrats' zeal to make him the leader of the party?
One of the questions that I would have for both of you before we go on to another topic is this. Rush Limbaugh aside, is this distraction healthy for a party that by its own admission is trying to rebuild coming off of the losses that it suffered last year? Sherrilyn, you first.
Ironically, I think this is actually all going to end up being helpful to the Republican Party, because what the party is going to learn is that while millions of people, some say 20 million, that may be an exaggerated figure, like to listen to Rush Limbaugh, it's not necessarily true that 20 million people want to vote Rush Limbaugh. And I think that many Americans, Republicans included, who may enjoy the show in the same way that many Democrats may enjoy listening to Michael Moore, they're going to still vote what makes sense for them and their families. And that means a more pragmatic way. They're not going to be voting their most extremist impulses that may make them laugh when they listen on the radio, or that they may even like when they listen on the radio. The reality is we're in a serious economic crisis. We've got two wars going on. We've got problems at home. And people vote for what's going to help them and their families. And what that means is that Rush is largely becoming irrelevant. It's a fringe element of the Republican Party. It didn't work with Sarah Palin. And ironically, it's going to help the Republicans refashion their party into one that's relevant and that speaks to more than the fringe element that would be willing to vote as well as listen to Rush's policy.
An argument could be made, Ron Christie, that what Rush Limbaugh is doing is galvanizing the base of the party at a time when, if you listen to what Michael Steele and others who are party leaders say, they want to expand the base of the party. Is this going to help them do that?
I think it will, and I absolutely agree with Sherrilyn's premise. Of course, I don't agree with the context, but I agree with the premise. This will be a good soul-searching for the Republican Party. We have been shellacked in the last two elections, and the party needs to recognize what it's for. You win elections by addition rather than subtraction, and we've lost voters by the millions over the last two elections. We need to have a honest soul-searching and recognize what we stand for, what the principles are for being a Republican Party, and offer clear policy alternatives in areas where we disagree with the president. And I think this will be a good process for us, because we need to articulate what we're for, as opposed to saying we're against this and we're against that. We need to be for something, be very positive, be very forward-looking, and that's what I think is going to be the net result of this Rush Limbaugh flap.
All right, let's move on to another topic. The economy is causing havoc, as we all know, on both sides of the Atlantic, and of course, this was the main topic of conversation between President Obama and British Prime Minister Gordon Brown in their meeting yesterday and in his appearance before a joint session of Congress today. The Prime Minister saying that the financial crisis is a global problem and it needs global solutions. My question to you, Sherrilyn, is will the Brown-Obama relationship be similar to that of Bush and Blair, thinking now how the relationship between those two may have cost Mr. Blair?
Well, to paraphrase Ron, let's hope not in content, in the sense that I think the idea of a strong U.S.-Britain alliance is a great one and an important one. It was unfortunately misused by President Bush to the detriment of both the United States, Great Britain. And so there's an opportunity to rebuild and refashion that relationship between Barack Obama and Gordon Brown. And it's a good idea, I think, to begin on the economic piece, because it is a global crisis. And because there are many people all over the world who are pretty PO'd at the United States, at some of our lax financial practices that really permitted this to spiral out of control in this country and to have a domino effect throughout the world. So I think it's important for Obama to reach out to some key allies and to begin to talk about a global solution and to rebuild relationship. It's a smart move. Gordon Brown is a pragmatic, low-key guy. He lacks the charisma of Tony Blair and hopefully will lack some of the impulses of Tony Blair that led him into so much trouble.
Now, Ron, in your former life working for former President Bush, you met with Gordon Brown, who was then Chancellor of the Exchequer in charge of Britain's finance. Just how sincere would you say, on one hand, and how capable, on the other, do you think Brown is with regard to solving the economic crisis?
I have to tell you, Tony, I led a delegation on behalf of the United States to Great Britain, upon which Tony Blair and Gordon Brown were the co-sponsors of the event, and I sat down with the then exchequer of the currency, Gordon Brown, for several hours in a one-on-one consultation, and his intellect is remarkable. His grasp and his comprehension of economic issues, to me, I found was particularly staggering. I mean, he really does understand what he's talking about. So I find that the American-British relationship has always been a strong one. I think that this president, Obama, and this new prime minister need to sit down. I'm glad that they have had the opportunity to sit down face-to-face to talk about the impact and the reach of this crisis, which has reached around the world. We must find a way out of this, and one of the ways that we will find a way out of this is close consultation and working with our allies, both here in the United States and in the banking industry, as well as our foreign leaders and our foreign friends around the world to dig our way out of this. So I'm very encouraged, not only by Gordon Brown, meeting with the president this morning, but also with the opportunity for the prime minister to address a joint session of Congress later in the day.
All right. Just before we go, one last topic we want to hit very, very briefly because we only have a few seconds left. It's another round for an Obama cabinet appointee, this time Kathleen Sebelius for Secretary of Health and Human Services. Sherilyn, I can break it down into one question really simply. It's actually a yes or no. Do you think that they've checked her taxes?
If they haven't at this point, you could knock me down with a feather. I'm sure she's been fully vetted, as they say.
All right. I appreciate both of you coming on. Our time is out. That was Sherilyn Ifill, a civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies. He is also a former special assistant to former President George W. Bush. He joined us from NPR's studios in Washington, D.C. Just ahead, black is back in the mainstream media, but is the coverage superficial? And pay the rent or head to the hairdresser? Even in this deep recession, that can still be a tough call. The Bloggers Roundtable, next. Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Lost in translation. That's what some are saying about racially coded language by President Barack Obama. An online article about what that very topic is drawing major attention on the web. And for more, we turn to Jeffrey Bennett. He is the digital producer for News and Notes. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tony.
So what is it that black and non-black people hear differently when they listen to President Obama?
Well, according to Politico.com reporter Nia Malika Henderson, she says, quote, "On matters of racial identity, many in the African-American community say Obama benefits from what's known as dog whistle politics. His language, mannerisms, and symbols resonate deeply with his black supporters, even as the references largely sail over the heads of white audiences," end quote. So those words come from Henderson's article, which is gaining traction both on Twitter and the larger blogosphere. It's titled, "Blacks and Whites Hear Obama Differently." And here's a clip of a situation which Henderson references when President Obama visited Ben's Chili Bowl in Washington, D.C. earlier this year. So that might have been a little hard to hear. So that was Obama responding to the cashier who asked if he wanted his change back, and he said, "No, we straight." But that ended up in the official White House pool report as, "No, we're straight," which technically is what he said, but it's not really what he said.
It has a different connotation altogether.
Yeah, so people versed in the culture know the difference. And so that's a really interesting piece, which is linked. The link can be found on our website.
Is that really the only example of that? Maybe the fist bump was another one.
Yeah, the fist bump, what some call his swagger as he gets on and off Air Force One and walks to the White House. I think black people and people, as I said, people who are versed in the culture see things differently in those sort of situations than people who aren't.
Now, are people complaining about this, or are they just noticing that there are signals, verbal and nonverbal, that they're having to interpret from a black president.
I would say that's the case. Not so much complaints, but noticing that there is a difference and talking about those.
Yeah, well, of course there is. I mean, and black people have had to learn to interpret signals from mainstream folks for a long time.
That's right.
But now the tables are sort of reversed, right. And it is something, I guess, that could be considered a little shocking to the system if you don't know quite what people mean.
Right. A reversal of the privilege, perhaps.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it. All right, we'll follow up on that. Now, sticking with politics, the question of who is in charge of the GOP has been big in the news lately. We just did that in the top of the show today. What is the consensus online?
Well, in some ways, the consensus is there is no consensus, right? So here's a sample of what some of our network of bloggers are saying. So on the blog Homeland Colors, he writes, Rush Limbaugh has never been elected to any office. He's the right-wing, angry version of Howard Stern. And on the blog Political Season, there's this about Michael Steele. Solving problems ought to be the measure of relevance for a black conservative. Black conservatives. Efficacy in the service of the black community and of our country in general should be the standard. Unless moderate Republicans begin to take control of their party, the party will go the way of the Whigs. And on Black Snob, she writes, I've watched Michael Steele and his efforts to rebrand the RNC, and this may be the only time that I ever say this in the history of mankind, but Rush Limbaugh is right when he says your job is to figure out how to get Republicans elected, not to go on a lengthy media award tour.
Well, she has an interesting point. And you know something else that Rush Limbaugh said, that he wasn't pulling it off very well in terms of being a talk show star.
Yeah.
He may have had a point there as well.
That's true.
All right. And what other stories have the attention of the so-called black blogosphere this week?
Well, the economy as always, but aside from those, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal admitting that he fabricated a story he recounted in his rebuttal to President Obama's congressional address. Reports that singers Chris Brown and Rihanna have reconciled and are back together. That's big on some of the entertainment blogs. And Tavis Smiley's 10th annual State of the Black Union, which we'll have more about coming up on the show.
All right, so a lot of stuff going on, right?
That's right.
All right, Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes, joining me here in the studios of NPR West. Jeffrey, thank you very much. Time now to see what headlines are firing up our bloggers. Is being black a commodity these days? Plus, the state of the black union and more on black women and their hair. Our bloggers are here to weigh in with us. Media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race and also blogs for AOL Black Voices. And political analyst Lenny McAllister. He blogs for several sites, including Hip Hop Republican, The Root, and AOL Black Voices. And we may or may not be joined later on by Felicia Harvey, editor of Black Politics on the Web. If she comes on, we will let her join the conversation. Now, welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, Carmen. My wonderful friend. How are you doing, Carmen?
Well, he was saying welcome to you. I guess you're his wonderful friend, Carmen.
You're yes, I am, hello. But I can't hear him.
Oh, you can't hear him?
No.
Turn your headphone up there. There you go. Can you hear now?
I'll say
I can
hello.
Hear
okay, now she
hi
can hear.
Hi again. Hi, Lenny.
Okay.
Hey, Carmen. Hey, everybody.
Listen, let's talk about this. Leading up to the presidential election and in the month since the inauguration, there's been a lot of focus in the media on blackness, some of it good, some of it not so good. Here's the bad. The Southern Poverty Law Center reports the number of hate groups, has increased by over 50% since 2000. California mayor criticized for sending an email showing watermelons in front of the White House. He resigned. Last month, a firestorm erupted over an offensive cartoon in the New York Post that many say equated a chimpanzee with the president of the United States. That's the bad. Here's some of the good. CNN aired a two-part special called Black in America. CNBC has a special report on the new black overclass. Carmen, is black back? Are we the new flavor, so to speak?
Well, I think it's interesting. I don't know if we're a new flavor, but I think that race and blackness and alternatively whiteness is getting more attention because of who Barack Obama is, a self-identified black man who's now our president. It's interesting that someone like me who talks about race all the time and until this Barack Obama's ascendancy sometimes felt like she was spitting in the wind, race and racism and the complexity of race in America, it never goes away. Sometimes we focus on it, sometimes we don't. But again, what I think all of this is doing is showing how our national discussion and our national priorities and our national views of how to grow our country, our influence in subtle and overt ways about how we think about race.
Well, you could say, couldn't you, Lenny, that the volume on race has been turned up in terms of the discussion. We just heard from our digital producer, Jeffrey Bennett, talking about how people are interpreting little things like "Nah, I'm straight," and the interpretation of that.
Well, I would agree. I mean, part of it is this. The dichotomy within Black America is so great now. You have the President of the United States, and you still have much of Black America, in particular young Black male youths, at a crisis situation. So you have one Black male that's the President of the United States, the most powerful man and the leader of the free world. And then you have what Cornel West implied was you have one Black man that's broken through and pierced the glass ceiling to get to the very, very top, but yet you still have to pay attention to people that are still stuck in the basement. And it's evident to everybody that there's this huge dichotomy that's there. And that was one of the challenges that we had over the course of the weekend to talk about, is how do we get the rest of those folks at least up to fair ground so that they can have an opportunity. There was a lot of conversations over the weekend about how many more Barack Obamas are there out there that may not become the President of the United States, but may accomplish things if we allow them to have a chance to accomplish and achieve. One thing that we forget about President Obama is this is not somebody that was successful from day one. He admittedly had fallen off the path. He admittedly was not the most adept or prepared or dedicated student. He overcame all that to become who he is now. How many more are like that we need to go get now? And it was very, you know, present at the conversation this Saturday, but it's out there in the widespread stream media as well nowadays.
Now, one of the things that Lenny's referring to, obviously, is the 10th annual State of the Black Union, which took place in Los Angeles over the weekend. The event is produced and hosted by Tavis Smiley, who brings together some of the best African-American thinkers and innovators to talk about the very issues that Lenny was referring to. Carmen, you were one of five official bloggers at the symposium. What were some of your observations of the event?
Well, my observations, I wrote about it a little bit in Black Voices and on my site all about race, and my observations were that it was a conversation that we have every day, that Black folks have intra-racially every day, that is now exposed to the wider audience, which is a great thing, because I do think that particularly racists sometimes promote the idea that Blacks have a groupthink, that we all think the same way, that we all are the same way. And I think one of the most important things about presenting a conversation on State of the Black Union, like conversation on State of the Black Union, have it broadcast by C-SPAN, is to show the diversity of thought within the Black community and the diversity of ideas about how we fix the problems facing Black and poor and urban people and people cut off from the main swim, so to speak, of pursuing the American dream.
Well, do you think, though, that diversity of thought is being accepted or understood or received by the larger American community?
I think it's going to have to be, because I think those of us who are step outside of the stereotypes, we're talking louder. We're talking louder through new media. We're talking louder through radio shows like this one and radio shows we create. We're showing up more on in conversations, in national conversations, on TV, people like Lenny, people like Kevin Ross, their voices step outside of the stereotypical, and this is not to denigrate them, but the Al Sharpton and the Reverend Jesse Jackson voices that particularly whites and white racists like to lump all Black thought into those particularly thought categories.
Well, let's talk about one, really briefly, one Black voice that is, I don't want to say out of the mainstream, but I think it would be fair to say out of the mainstream of Black America. That's Michael Steele, mm-hmm. the RNC chairman, who got into this brouhaha with Rush Limbaugh. Lenny, what's your take on both what Steele said and Steele's subsequent apology?
Well, what Steele said symbolizes the culture war within the Republican Party that needs to transpire. You have the old guard that is moving further and further away from what America looks like, feels like, and acts like in the 21st century. And you have Michael Steele, who is the representation of where the Republican Party may need to start moving towards, somebody that's media savvy, that is familiar with the urban environments, that's not afraid to go into different environments where he's not viewed well and still feel comfortable in his skin. Unfortunately, I see what he did as far as the apology as being more of somebody caving in to pressure to raise money, to lose the little backing that the RNC has right now. And it's something that he probably politically needed to do, although I would after meeting the man, would have to say ethically and morally he did not want to do. I agree with his statements. Rush Limbaugh is a hybrid of a politico and an entertainer. This is a man that makes millions and millions and millions of dollars every year to rile up the base from a microphone 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. That is his job. So whether people get elected or not, it doesn't necessarily affect him as long as he keeps that contract. Michael Steele, on the other hand, is on the hook to make sure that congressmen get elected in 2010. We start flipping the seats as far as from a Republican point of view in the Senate and the House of Representatives, as well as these state capitals in 2010. Rush Limbaugh's not on the hook for that. All Rush needs to do is get in front of a microphone and rail, especially now that he has a Democratic administration in there. If you look at his ratings, the best days for him was when President Clinton was in the White House. Glory days are here again for Rush Limbaugh. So you're seeing that there's a contrast between somebody that's in the media and somebody that's in politics, and it's you'll see the culture war within the Republican Party brew and bubble as a result.
You know, you're absolutely right. Go ahead, Carmen.
I want to talk a little bit about Michael Steele from a more racially framed perspective for me. I had the great good fortune to talk to Michael Steele at the State of the Black Union, and we had a great talk, and I shared with him very openly that he has an ally in me and someone who wishes to see the GOP attract more Black, Latino, all sorts of people of color, because I believe the strength of our democracy rests in two strong, vibrant parties. And I also believe the Democratic Party takes the Black vote for granted. Now, when I heard his apology and read his apology on Politico, it broke my heart, frankly. I was very saddened by it.
Tell me why.
And because when I met him and when I see him, I do perceive him as a strong Black man. And whether his views agree with mine, that's not what it's about. He's a strong Black man. He is talking about issues, inclusive issues that affect all of America, including Black America. And I think the GOP needs that. I understand the dollars and cents of why he apologized to Rush Limbaugh. But it felt like an over-apology to me. It felt like groveling, to be frank, and to see it brought back for me, because I do believe Rush Limbaugh is a bigot, and I can back that up with many things I've heard him say. I believe Rush Limbaugh is a bigot. So to see this man to feel he has to apologize in such a way that I feel was emasculating to this bigot broke my heart. If Joe Scarborough is taking on Michael Steele for the way he apologized, it's pretty remarkable, frankly.
Well, I tell you what. Rush Limbaugh, whether you think he is a bigot or not, one thing you cannot argue about him, he is a professional in terms of being on the air.
Yes.
Michael Steele is not.
Right.
And when you put an amateur up against a professional, that's what's going to happen.
But Tony, I disagree with that a little bit. I mean, the bottom line is Michael Steele is a polished and seasoned politician. He's
not
an attorney. This is somebody that should know how to wordsmith and should know how to not step in it.
It is not the same thing. Trust me on that. It is not. He is a politician. You're absolutely correct. But when it comes to being an entertainer slash pundit slash whatever you'd like to describe Rush Limbaugh as, he's been at it a lot longer than Michael Steele, and he's really professional at it. Unfortunately, our time has run out. We didn't even get to talk about the hair. You know, that's the thing. People get mad at us because they say, well, why are you talking about things that are not important? And yet when we get responses, the response that we got to our segment on hair was far exceeded many of the other kinds of responses that we've gotten on other topics. So we will revisit that. Really quickly, Carmen, I give you 10 seconds.
I just wanted to say, because particularly with Black women, our hair has a lot to do with our identity and our self-esteem.
All right. That was Carmen Dixon, who writes the blog All About Race. She also blogs for AOL Black Voices. And we were joined by Lenny McAllister. He blogs for several sites, including Hip Hop Republican, The Root, and AOL Black Voices. You can find links to their blog as well as to ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Meeting up with old school pals can be a pleasure or a real pain. This would appear to be the case, for some at least, on the second season of the TV reality show High School Reunion. The class of 1988 from Arizona's Chandler High School gathered on the romantic island of Kauai, but it wasn't really a love-in for all involved.
I said something mean to you about your picture. I said you look like Buckbeak back in
Like
like something that you.
No, that's me. That's
said, like,
how
said,
it was.
Like,
okay.
Said it 10 times, but, like, I didn't hear you the first 9. Like a point that you're trying to make.
That was Dennis, the so-called troublemaker, ruffling the feathers of his former housemates. His comment was directed toward Shalonda Warren Clark, and she joins us now. Welcome, Shalonda.
Thank you, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. That was interesting, watching you meeting up with your old housemates, your old classmates, I should say, staying together in a house on the island of Kauai, and you were the only African-American woman. There was another African-American guy who was there, and everything seemed to be going smoothly. Let me just tell the audience that everyone on the program was identified by what they were, the troublemaker, the cheerleader, the whatever, whatever. But yours said the pregnant girl. How'd you feel about that?
It was surprising, because I'd never considered myself to be the pregnant girl. So when they gave me that title, everyone that knows me was kind of put back and put off by it. And some people from school even said, you know, Shalonda, I'd forgotten that you had gotten pregnant in high school, because that was so not the thing that I remember most about you. So it was meant to be negative, but I really feel that there's going to be something positive that comes out of that.
Why did you decide to do the show anyway?
I decided to do the show because I thought that there were people in situations like mine where they were in a situation that they didn't anticipate, but that they have control, and I wanted to tell them that even though you make choices, after you make those choices, then you take actions. And your actions can be to be a victim, or your actions can be to empower yourself. And I wanted to say, you know what? I didn't say I became pregnant in high school, so I'm going to be on a fixed income. I'm going to wait and see what happens next. I made choices to better myself and better my life for my children.
So you wanted to say that just because you got pregnant in high school, that wasn't the end for you, and there was a life that you could have, and a fulfilling one, which obviously you have, correct?
Exactly. That's exactly my point, Tony.
So everything is going along smoothly, and you guys are having a good time. You know, you're swimming, you're eating, you're, you know, laughing and joking, and then all of a sudden, two guys show up at the house, dun-da-da-dun-da-da-dun, right? And then here comes trouble. Now,
yeah.
Literally in the name of Dennis, who called you buckwheat. Now, I have to ask you, because some of this, you know, it's hard to tell whether it was scripted or whether it was, you know, contrived or spontaneous. What was it?
I think it was spontaneous when he said it, when no one was around. But I don't know if maybe he was encouraged to say that in front of me, and I don't know if it was just ignorance of people not realizing how offensive that was. But what I also don't think that anyone knew just how deep he would go, because I don't think that he had a bottom. I think that for him, he just wanted to keep going and going and going.
And did you know this guy in high school?
I never met him before seeing him in the house in Hawaii. So, you know, if someone had looked at the picture and made a comment, you know, saying that it wasn't a flattering picture, because people that know me and love me were like, oh, my God, that's the worst picture I've ever seen of you in my life. That's fine. But this person didn't know me or anything about me. And to look at something and then make a statement like that and then to continue to say it, I knew that he meant it to be an insult and derogatory, and that's what really set me off.
So as bad as that might have been for you, plus he went on, it appears as if he tried to hit on you and he was drunk and a number of things and you got angry with him. But that seems to be, Shalonda, the whole point of reality TV, to put people in these uncomfortable situations so the audience can watch it.
Yes.
How do you feel about being put in that circumstance?
I thought that I would be able to go and be in the background. I thought I'd be able to go and just be supporting cast, and to be thrown into that situation, it was very uncomfortable, and I really didn't know what to do. I was kind of like in the headlights, because all that I could think about was, I have a 16-year-old daughter at home, I have a husband, I have people that when they see this, they are going to freak out. So in my mind, I kept thinking, don't hit him.
I wondered why you didn't smack him. Also, I also wondered why you didn't get up and walk off the show. You gave the impression to me that you thought about just saying, you know, forget this.
my thoughts were remove myself from the situation because I knew that I couldn't control Dennis or anyone else. So the only thing that I had control over was me.
Now, did you talk to the producers at all about any of this? And if so, what did you say and what did they say?
I talked to the producers and I told them that I wanted to leave. And the producers told me that that was my choice. And then there were people, and I don't know how much of this I can say, but there were people in the house that you'll see the last scene where there's several of us in a room, and those people came to me and said, Shalonda, don't leave. Give us a chance. Trust us that we have your best interest in heart and that we care about you, and we don't want you to be unhappy and uncomfortable, and just give us tonight to figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to handle it.
And you were not the only person, we should point out to the audience, who was victimized by this Dennis person. There was some homophobia involved there, mm-hmm. and there was some misogyny going mm-hmm. on. There were all sorts of bad things mm-hmm. happening that make, unfortunately, for good reality TV.
Yes, I think it makes for great reality TV. The hard part was being there and seeing those things happen, and I don't know if you actually see me get up and walk away because I said, this is too much for me, and I know that this guy is drunk.
And he didn't graduate with you. He graduated a year later, the show said. So was he just was a plant then, I surmise.
He had a role. He had a role. His role was to come in and shake it up. But I don't think that, you know, so I looked at him as like being a hornet in a jar, and they shook it up and let the lid off. But they didn't know that he, you know, had so much venom. But it's just something that I don't find tolerable.
Now, when the show was over, did you have any other contact with him?
No, I did not.
So that was it? You haven't heard from him or anything like that?
I did see Dennis at the premiere. We went to a premiere in Arizona where all of the cast went, the majority of the cast.
Now, how did that go?
He was drinking and having a good time. He wasn't offensive. But he definitely had some things that would require more attention than we could have given him in a two-week Hawaii retreat.
All right, final thing is this. This was your 20-year reunion,
yes.
right?
Yes.
So you're going to go to the 25?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That one person does not make or break me, and the relationships that I developed with the other people on the show was just incredible.
Okay, well, I appreciate your coming on. It was interesting, a little painful, but interesting to watch.
And the pain continues. I do believe the saga will continue next week as well.
Shalonda, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tony.
That was Shalonda Warren Clark. She was one of the participants in High School Reunion, the class of 88, now showing on TV Land. It is not easy for musicians of color to break into the classical music scene. Reports say just 4% of the musicians in national professional orchestras are black or Hispanic. But some organizations are working to change that trend. 15 years ago, Azira Hill started the Talent Development Program with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra to nurture African-American and Latino students. Now, one of the program's participants, cellist Kari Joyner, has just won first place in the junior division of the 12th Annual Sphinx Competition. Kari and Azira join us now. Welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
First of all, Kari, congratulations to you on winning this honor. And tell us, what piece did you play and why did you choose it?
Thank you. Actually, I had to play several pieces. The pieces were actually chosen by the competition's judges. And I had to perform the Boccherini Concerto, First Movement in B-flat Major, as well as two African-American spirituals arranged by Lawrence Brown. So I chose Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen, and Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child. And the other two pieces I had to perform were actually contrasting movements from the J.S. Bach 6th Suite, and I played the Allemande and the Courant.
Well, Azira, tell us about how important it is for you to encourage black and Hispanic students to participate in classical music, and how does the organization, the Talent Development Program, help them?
First place, music is very important to me in my life personally. Secondly, the fact that there are so very few black musicians around the country performing in major symphonies, that also was important. Well, what we found out after much research was that many of the black musicians do not attend conservatories. And so that's why we started trying to prepare the students to first was to audition for the symphony, for the youth symphony. And then it has evolved that now they are into conservatories and major other music programs.
Carrie, let me talk with you about you for a moment, because I'm imagining you're 17 years old, correct?
Yes, yes.
I would imagine that at that age, many of your classmates are trying to lay down a mixtape or some hip hop beats, and maybe you're trying to do that as well. Are there issues for you though, being young and playing classical cello?
I haven't actually had too much of a problem with that. I have been playing now for 9 years, and I think for the amount of time that I've been playing, I think that's one of the reasons of why it's not so much of a problem, because I do actually have peers, as you said, that are not sort of, that can't share the same interests and aspirations as I do. So I have to every now and then explain to them what I do, but I haven't run into too many problems with them having a hard time understanding. And some of my friends actually find it interesting and intriguing.
Azira, how difficult is it to recruit people to be a part of this talent development program, and how many kids do you have?
We have 25 in the program presently. It's not difficult at all. For instance, on the last audition we have about 50 to apply for 5 positions. So the news is getting out that this opportunity is available. And there's great interest in the community.
How difficult is it for them, for young musicians, particularly those of color, to acquire the necessary instruments? Instruments are not cheap, at least the good ones aren't.
You are correct. Very difficult. We hopefully, sometime in the near future, we will establish an instrument fund.
Kari, you have your own cello?
Yes, I do.
And how long have you had that?
I've had this cello actually not too long. I just got this cello, but the cello I had before that I'd had for about 6 years.
When did you first develop your interest in this kind of music?
Okay. Actually, I have 2 older brothers that play violin, and when I was very young, around 7 or 8 years old, I took up the cello mainly with the help of my parents, and seeing my brothers play, because they hearing them play was always something that interested me a lot. So I decided to choose the cello because I liked the sound of the instrument. And once I started playing the cello, it something about it captivated me, and I knew that it was definitely something that I was going to continue seriously.
I'm going to ask you, I know you have your cello with you in the studio there.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you to play something in just a second. But before I do that, I'm curious as to what your impressions were, if you paid attention, which I'm imagining you probably did, to Yo-Yo Ma on the day of the inauguration.
I was very pleased with him. I've always enjoyed Mr. Ma performing because he is such a intriguing player to watch, because he really knows exactly what it is that he wants to express and what it is he wants to say with his instrument, which is something that I think is really, really interesting. And it's actually something that many musicians find difficult to do, because we're always, as musicians, searching for our voice.
Well, we have a national audience that would love to hear from you. Would you play something for us now?
Sure. I'm going to play a little bit of the Allemande from Bach's 6th Suite. Thank you.
Very nice. Very nice. We hope you have a wonderful and long career, Kari. I'm sure that you will. What's next for you?
Well, actually, I'm in the process of applying to many colleges around the country. And after this process, I'll have to decide which school has what opportunities each school gives and who I think I would best be suited for in terms of studying with. And I think that is definitely something that I'll be considering in the next several weeks. And I hope that all goes well with that.
Well, we hope it does as well. Thank you for coming in. Azira, thank you very much for bringing him and for providing the opportunity that you do.
Thank you
very much.
Azira Hill, founder of the Talent Development Program of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra 15 years ago, and cellist Kari Joyner is the first place junior division laureate in the 12th annual Sphinx competition and a member of the Talent Development Program. They both joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta.